Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Jason Cohen, founder of WP Engine.
The question is, what can you learn from customer interviews? I don't think you can use customer reviews to know, can I build this or would you buy this feature? But I do think you can use customer interviews for stuff like what we're just talking about. What is their life like? What do they care about already or not care about already? What do they do? What are their workflows like? They see this problem or don't they? Do these compelling events exist? And if so, what? These are things where if you build the product, you don't learn those things, actually. And you ask the customer, they actually can tell you, because they're not solving the problem for you. They're not building the product for you. They're just telling you about themselves, that they can do.
This is Jason. He built four technology startups, both bootstrapped and funded, both alone and with co-founders. He grew all of them to more than $1 million in annual revenue and has sold two. Beyond that, he'd been an angel investor and a founding member of Capital Factory, Austin-based incubator and co-working space since 2009. Since 2007, he's been documenting his experiences and thoughts about early-stage startups on his blog, A Smart Bear. Based on the challenges he faced as the blog grew, he founded WP Engine in 2010. It's a platform that provides brands with the solutions that they need to create remarkable sites and apps on WordPress. And their mission? To help customers win online. And that inspired me, and hence I invited Jason to my podcast. We explore his lessons in building successful companies. He elaborates on the importance of getting the problem definition right and understanding what moves potential customers to buy. He shares his views on how to select your market and betting on a super specific niche. He also talks in detail about his rules for attracting funding or not and what WP Engine did during COVID to keep growing. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, what questions to ask to start your business with a solid foundation for long-term success? Secondly, what makes hyper-specific SaaS companies grow faster? Thirdly, his first principle for thinking about raising funds to ensure you stay in control. And lastly, what he's looking for when making big bets when it comes to profitability. Well, hi, Jason. Thank you for being the guest on the podcast today and making time available.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I reached out to you because I've become a big fan of your long-form blogs. I mean, everybody that's listening to the podcast, check out Smart Bear. Google that and you'll find a wealth of information. I thought I was writing a lot, but Jason is possibly exceeding that by at least 2x and really, really useful stuff. And yeah, I mean, I started following you a while ago, I think last year, middle of last year or so. And yeah, I've been enjoying it since. So I just had to reach out and get you as a guest on my podcast. Before we start talking about your journey, founder of WordPress Engine, WP Engine, what drives you as a person? What do you get energy from?
I think right now, it's things like this is really fun. Talking about, I mean, I've been doing startups for over 20 years, got two unicorns founded, still at WP Engine, 14 years into the journey. Bootstrapped and raised money separately. And it's really fun to take all of that experience and give it back. So I've been, as you say, writing for 16 years. And yeah. It's edifying personally to try to take all these thoughts or learnings or techniques that we've found are useful or et cetera, and think them out and put them down. That's fun. But what's really fun is when people say, oh, I really needed to hear this, or we use this to do whatever. and often credit me for some kind of success, which is not really true. Obviously, I'm glad they feel that way. That's edifying. But obviously, their own activities and other external reasons are why they're successful. But even just for someone to think that, it feels so good personally. So it's a nice mixture of stuff that I like and I think a good impact on other folks.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. That's also the reason why I keep doing it, you know, just the feedback. And also the writing in itself just gets you sharper and sharper on the topic every line you write. That's good. Someone needs to write it down, right? And otherwise can learn from it. So kind of turning it into the journey, you said you've been writing for 18 years, two unicorns, and you did, VC-funded companies, bootstrap type companies, and you became the founder of WP Engine in 2010. What was the problem that you and your co-founders saw that was screaming for a solution?
So the previous startup called SmartBear, which is why that's what my online moniker is, A SmartBear, for that reason, I had written a book there on our topic that our software was about, and that was really effective from a marketing perspective. And also at the time, which was like 2006, blogging was popular. Like, it was cool to be a blogger then. And so you had certain companies like 37 Signals and other folks that I had been reading when I was getting started on my entrepreneurial journey, like Eric Sink and Joel Spolsky. I don't even know if it was called blogging then, but that's what it was. And so I thought, oh, well, we'll make a company blog at SmartBear and it'll become the voice of the company, like 37 Signals is. And then plus that's cool. And plus writing is good for marketing. Yeah. But no one ever wrote on it but me. And it wasn't very good for marketing, actually. And so it just became my personal blog. Now, I sold that company in 2007 and then left in 2009 because my wife was pregnant. And, you know, it had been 7 years and that was 100% bootstrapped. So bootstrapped for 7 years and sold it. It was just time for the next chapter, right? Just a natural time to do something different. So I was a stay-at-home dad for a year. During that time, I kept writing because that was something where there was no deadlines, no expectations, not really even any goals, certainly doesn't need to make money. And so it was a way to stay intellectually connected with the rest of the world while having a new child, which makes you, you know, scrambles your brains and makes it so you don't sleep and so forth. So in doing that, it started to become more popular, maybe because I was writing on it and so it would get on link sharing sites like Hacker News and then crash. The server it was on would crash because you get a lot of traffic at once and it would go down. And I was using WordPress, which even then was the most popular blogging software. Even then, about 10 or 11% of the entire internet was on WordPress, which is kind of infinitely big. If you're going to start a company and your market is 10% of the internet, that's kind of infinity, right? It's close enough to infinity. I used to say, like, write down the size of the internet and then booger flick 1-0 off of it. That's how big. It's really big, you know? So I called other bloggers up and I said, hey, how do you keep WordPress from going down when you get a lot of traffic? And the answer was always, I don't know, but if you find it, tell me because I need that. Mm-hmm. So then that turns into, you know, this is a common thing where you say, I have the problem, so I solved it for myself. And a lot of people say, like, that's how you started a company. And it is true. That's a very common story. So obviously that's my story too. But a lot of those things where you see a problem and you solve it for yourself, most of the time that's not a business. And the reason is that there's all these other hurdles you have to go over for the business to really be successful. So, like, you saw the problem, but do other people even have it? Do they know they have it? Because if you have to evangelize, that's a lot harder and more expensive and slower and everything. Like, do they already agree? Are they already looking for the answer? Even better, do they have a budget already? Are they willing to pay to solve the problem, or do they just have the problem? A lot of times in consumer products, for example, do millions of people have the problem? Yes, but people don't like to spend money on anything, especially nowadays where everything amazing is free, quote unquote. Obviously, you're selling things like your own attention for ads and your privacy. Like, oh, it's not really free, but like in a direct spend sense, it is free. So it's very hard to charge even if people have the problem. So you go through all these hoops. Those are not all of them, but those are just some of the many hurdles. Can I get to them? Can I market to them? Is that cost effective enough? Can I be competitive against whatever is there already? If there's a lot of competitors, how do I stand out? If there's not, does that mean the market doesn't exist? And how will I show that it does? So there's just a million hoops to jump over. So the whole, like, I had a problem, so I solved it is an interesting spark, but there's so many other things that have to go right. So, okay, so I had the spark. I went and then did customer interviews. And to your point, I've written up how I do that and what
Love
I did
that
there.
book.
And I
It's excellent.
continued doing that at WP Engine as we grew with different customer segments or added new product lines eventually. Again, it's 14 years old, so there has been time for all those kinds of things to happen without, quote unquote, getting defocused, you know? And we kept using this. So you can go read that. I mean, we can talk about it if you want, or you can read it, whatever. Anyway, so I talked to 50 people, 50. Which took like 3 or 4 months, because it takes forever to get people on the phone and find people.
Yeah, true.
But I was able to figure out that there were 4 things. And if I did them, people would pay 10 times as much for WordPress hosting as they were paying. Not necessarily all four, but like if you had these four, at least one would trigger somebody, you know, a lot of the time. And the 4 things were speed, make the site fast, scale, which was my problem, security, it's just kind of obvious maybe, and service, but meaning the tech support would answer questions specifically about WordPress, not just about the server or the internet still up, but about WordPress. That's what people would pay for. Another thing that's a good lesson out of there is
let me pause you there, because I mean
sure.
you just highlighted like one of your blogs that I also found fascinatingly good, typically how you go through that and how you check things, because a lot of companies indeed they first of all think, okay, let's define the problems and then we start brainstorming solutions and then we build it and then we start testing there. You did it completely the opposite around.
Right.
Yes, indeed, do a brainstorm about the problems, but then you kind of formulated hypotheses and that's what you started testing.
That's right. You have to write down what you think is true so that, number one, you can write good interview questions to test that don't lead the witness towards what you want it to be. And when there's new information, it's more obvious. So you can adjust your hypotheses, with the idea being that you're iterating towards true hypotheses or mostly true.
It's true. Yeah, and that's exactly also what I've seen in my role when I was heading up product marketing at Unit 4.
Yeah.
It's about the question that you ask. And like you say, if you ask a question in a certain way, your customer will just answer it. And you're biased towards hearing what you want to hear.
That's right. Especially when you ask it like I give the example in the article about security, because this is what happened. And you say something like, are you concerned with security with all the bad people out on the internet? You know, who's going to say no? That just makes you sound dumb. But do people really care? Is that what they really think of? And the answer is most people don't. Most people are like, no, I don't know. I just pay GoDaddy. I don't really think of it. But here's what does happen. If you get hacked and you know it, and I say and you know it because, by the way, 12% of the websites that come to WP Engine every day are hacked already. So if you're hacked and you know it, that's why I'm adding that, right? Then it's a horrible experience. You feel violated. It's expensive to get it fixed. You feel like it's urgent. You're wondering how to ever prevent this. It's really bad. And so right at that moment, you're ready to spend a lot more to prevent this.
True.
And that's a general lesson for all companies, that people do not wake up in the morning. This is like a Bob Moesta type of thing to say, but people don't wake up in the morning saying, today, I want to change WordPress hosts. Like, that's, who says that, you know? But sometimes someone does say that. And so to find out why is that? Can I cause that to happen with something like marketing? Like, sometimes that's called demand gen. It's great if you can do that. But more, it's like, no, what are the circumstances where that's happening? What kind of customer segments does it happen more? Is there something, can I catch them at that moment? Like, there's all kinds of good questions that are not obvious how to answer it, of course. None of this is easy, but that is more the right line of thinking. So the security, actually, so I thought going in, everyone would care about security. I was totally wrong. But what I did find is, oh, there's these moments and times and things where they do. Oh, and actually that's true of all the things. People don't care about scale until they have their best day ever and go down and they realize that was most of their traffic for the whole year and they didn't get it. Then they care and so forth. Or like if their SEO expert says, hey, if your site's slow, you don't get ranked higher by Google. There's nothing I can do. You've got to get the site faster or you can't get ranked higher. Now, all of a sudden, they're willing to spend more to have a fast site. So there are these specific things. So I would say for any company, this is true. What are these triggers that say, you know, whether it's a, again, segment or an event or an industry or because they saw something or, you know, what happens where someone is ready now? That's a super important question. And that's the kind of thing you can find with customer interviews. One of the things, I don't want to over-index on customer interviews. I think it's dumb not to do it at all and just build, because then you just don't know a lot of stuff you could have known. On the other hand, I also agree with people who say, you don't really know till you build it and see if they buy. You don't really know till then. I actually agree with that too. So I think the question is, what can you learn from customer interviews? For example, I don't think you can learn features. Nope. What do you think about this feature? What do you think about? I mean, so many times, even in the last 12 months, I've been on customer calls. Would you buy this? Yes. Then we build it and they don't buy it. Even now, you know, I don't know what to do with that, right? So I don't think you can use customer reviews to know, can I build this and or would you buy this feature? But I do think you can use customer interviews for stuff like what we're just talking about. What is their life like? What do they care about already or not care about already? What do they do? What are their workflows like? Do they generate themselves? They see this problem or don't they? Do these compelling events exist? And if so, what? Where do they, when it does, where do they go? Like, what does this person do? Do they search on Google? Are there like Slack communities they're in? Like, where do they go for stuff? Because that's where you need to be if you build it.
Yeah.
These are things where if you build the product, you don't learn those things, actually. And you ask the customer, they actually can tell you, because they're not solving the problem for you. They're not building the product for you. They're just telling you about themselves, that they can do. So I feel like customer interviews are very important, but they're for a certain category of stuff, not the other category of stuff. So,
Yeah, well, completely agree. So you talked about, you know, you found out through all these interviews and testing the hypothesis that you had, that there were four things. And if you would combine them, the willingness to pay would go up by a good number, and the willingness to pay a premium even more. So how did you figure out, like, okay, so they're interested in that and that, and then when you combine them together, has it got to do with just that the problem exponentially grows and the criticality?
I just don't know whether the combination was important or whether it was with these four things you cover most people's thing. In other words, that most people have one of those. And so if you have these four, you cover most people. Is it that, or is it that you have a combination? I actually don't know the answer. Two of these things go together, the speed and scale. If the server can turn the site around faster, then it can scale more because you can serve more per second with the same amount of resources. So there's a little bit of a connection, at least with two of them. But I don't know because I don't have a counterfactual to find out.
No fun. But yeah, like absolutely a recommendation to read that particular blog. Let's dig in a little bit more. So 2010, you founded WP Engine. One of the questions I always like to ask is, in hindsight now, 14 years later, what decision has appeared to be really important for the success that you have today? Can you name one?
Or I would say there's a couple depending for different stages of the company.
Uh-huh.
We even had competitors where their growth rate never kicked up. We were about the same size and then their growth rate didn't kick up. So there, the decisions that went around that might have been more important. So I would say if I had to pick just one for the whole company, it's being in a large and growing market. I mentioned WordPress was big. WordPress is now 43% of the internet. So it was already infinity. Now it's like four times infinity. Interestingly, we're now also so large and we're at such scale that that isn't infinity anymore to us. So WordPress powers 43% of the top 10 million domains, but we are on our own power like 2.4%, not of WordPress, of all websites in that category. We're about the same size as DigitalOcean and Google Cloud in terms of how many public websites we host. At that size, like, it's not like we're out of room to grow, not at all. It's just now the market size does matter. Like, we're not going to have 60% of all WordPress sites. That's ridiculous. And we shouldn't, because that's not our target segment anyway, isn't that. So it actually isn't infinity anymore. However, certainly you get to this point, that's the case. And I feel like for most companies, that's the right move. Not all, of course, but the reason that's great, and a lot of times, of course, if you want to have a $1 billion company, and by that I even mean $1 billion in ARR, then of course the market has to be big, because otherwise, where's the money come from? Now, you might create the market from scratch, or you might enter a large market, but either way, like something big has to happen. But I mean this even for an indie startup or a bootstrap company that's designed for profit and lifestyle, and not, well, I shouldn't say that all companies have a lifestyle. That are built for profit and self-funding and creativity, independence, and so forth. Still, a large and growing market is nice because there are people actually spending money now. So a lot of the hurdles we just said, the answer is yes, it's fine if the market is large and growing. It just answers that. I guess they do have the problem. I guess they know it. I guess they already have a budget. I guess they're already spending, you know, like it just answers all these in the affirmative, which is awfully de-risking. Mm-hmm. Also, there's going to be lots of niches. Okay, well, that's where profits are. And so
now, maybe there's a good intersection there because what I see, I mean, I completely agree. Large TAM is important. But what I also see is that too many B2B SaaS companies at the end focus too much on a large total addressable market without really paying a lot of attention. Like, why would they win? So how have you gone about that?
Yeah, yeah. So you want to be in a big space so that there's lots of niches, lots of ways to win. Also, lots of channels and marketing potentials, lots of segments to target. Because that way, if the first one isn't right, there's another one to try. How nice. Whereas if it's a tiny market, especially if it's shrinking, there may not be another thing to try. There may not be a solution here. Certainly higher risk. Also, it becomes a zero-sum game. If the market is fixed or falling, then all the competitors are cutthroat. Because this is all the business. Like it really is. Like either I get it or you get it, and that's the end. So we have to really attack each other. That's a rough place to be for anybody, and especially a startup. Whereas if everything's growing, you know, not only can you not afford to try to capture everything, you don't even need to or want to. So like it's okay. There's a lot of room for people to be. And WordPress felt like that for the last 15 years, certainly. Yep. So I feel like that's good. Now, as you say, but how do you zero in? And for that, I would say one thing is people are afraid to zero into a little niche because they feel like that will make them too small. Their brand will be too little. The market they can get is too little. So that's one thing to address is this fear that it's too small. And then the other question is, how do I find? Okay, fine. But let's say I get over that. How do I find it? Okay. So first, the fear. What's nice about a super specific target persona, market, et cetera, is that suddenly it becomes very easy to communicate and to locate them. Yeah. The language that you use, the positioning that you have, the specific thing that you say you do, and also the things that you're bad at, that you're like, I'm bad at that. So I'm good at this, where do I advertise? What do I say there? All this stuff becomes much clearer. And that's part of why it's so valuable because of that. Also, you can be very opinionated. You can have more personality that's specific to that. All of these things are very valuable if you're a new unknown brand. It means you're saying something. So all that is a lot of very valuable and effective.
Let me make a small interruption here. Jason just made a critical remark about what got them traction. Being super specific about the niche and the persona, even though they could help thousands of other people with their horizontal platform. The goal is to resonate with the right people. The people that suffer the most from the problem that you solve. They will notice you and take action because what you do is valuable and critical to them. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They acknowledge that they cannot please everyone, then create something valuable and desirable and aim to be different, not just better. And you can learn these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
Whereas trying to just, you know, do random things to random people is not effective. Now, the worry is like, okay, but then only those people will like it. But that's never what happens. And you can look over and over again at brands who are hyper-specific and hyper-everything. It is never the case that only that little market is interested. No. And here's the reason, is that what you're really saying is, look, every product you buy, there's trade-offs. This product is good at A and B and neutral at C and D and bad at E and F. And also the price is G. And this other product, it's different mix. Other product, different things altogether and so on. That's how it goes. It's a bag of stuff. And so when you're very specific about what your bag of stuff is, there are more people than just that little target who agree that your bag of stuff is the right set of trade-offs. Not that it's perfect for them, but then none of them are perfect for them. That's by the way, if a competitor is really honestly, truly perfect for them, they should go with the competitor because it's not a good fit for you. Like that's what they should do. But that's unusual. And so really it's more like you're being so specific about what your bag of stuff is. It's easier for people to make the decision. Oh, okay. I can live without a D because I have A. It's easier for them to make that decision. And they do, in fact, in practice, make that decision. And so you end up selling to 100 times more people than your so-called hyper-targeted segment, because they're making the same kind of decisions on the trade-off. So that's why you shouldn't be afraid of that. That's why it shouldn't happen.
Okay. But was that the strategy that WP Engine followed as well? I mean, of course, when you started, okay, 10% of the internet, where do you start? So what was the niche that you picked first and why?
So it was freelancers and small agencies who were building websites that also are fairly small, but not teeny tiny. So almost all the internet is like long tail, teeny tiny stuff that no one ever sees. Mm-hmm. That's almost the whole internet in terms of N, right? But in terms of dollars spent, everything's the big stuff or middle sized stuff. That's where all the dollars are spent on the internet in terms of web hosting. So for us, it was like, oh, okay, well, we're not taking on McDonald's.com, right? We're like, so it's not enterprise. It's not way up there. But also we're not in this long tail, like GoDaddy type stuff. Because we're expensive. Remember, we're 10 times as expensive, right? So what we are is kind of this mid-market where you care enough about the site, like one of those four things, but ultimately you care enough about your website that you're like, yeah, I do want to be faster. Or, yeah, I do want the security, whatever it is that you said, yeah, I'm ready to do that. That's because I value this, but you're not McDonald's.com. So you can call that mid-market if you'd like. Sure. And so specifically the freelancers who serve people who are in that mid-market. And also we started in just America. I mean, we didn't limit to America, but it was stuff like, yeah, but our tech support is during American Central Time and we only take dollars and it's only through credit cards that, you know, and not other kinds of forms of payment. And also we don't do purchase orders, which also keeps us down in that smaller, you know, size of the mid-market and so on and so forth. So that kind of stuff, while not a physical limitation, did effectively bias everything towards that. Also, we were starting to become more well-known within the WordPress community, but not beyond that. So that's another, obviously WordPress itself is another thing. So here's a lot, I just listed a bunch of Venn diagram circles. And so when you get in the middle of that circle, there's us.
Perfect.
But what happened is lots of people, like we had lots of sites from large companies, just not their main.com. They did a campaign for some new product launch or a whole product because they have 100 products. Each product has a website. Oh, yep. Or it was something like, we do run McDonald's Denmark because McDonald's Denmark is only serving 5 million people. So it needs to be fast. It needs to move quickly. It needs to be run locally and not under the same cost structures and systems as McDonald's.com. And so, oh, okay. So then that's a way. So actually large companies have use cases that fit in. And that's a perfect example where they're nowhere near at the beginning our super target. And yet there they were. Now that was the first many years was like that. Now, again, hyper growth. And so eventually you can decide to expand your target market if you have the money to do it and you hire for it. Like when we expanded into enterprise, which we did, we had sales teams, marketing teams, customer service teams, engineering stuff. Like we invested millions and millions of dollars in people and processes to add that on. So that wasn't just like, oh, we'll just start advertising somewhere else. No. This was a whole concerted effort. So of course you can go expand later as you're scaling, right? But we did nothing of that until we had like way beyond product market fit with that initial concept.
At what stage where was the company at that point in time? How many million dollar was your revenue?
Definitely tens of millions of revenue and maybe 80 people, 90, 100 people, something like that, where we started really starting that.
I'm glad you say that because so many companies, you know, they're okay with kind of starting in a small niche, but then they say, okay, well, now we've done 200K, so we are expanding. And the point they're trying to make here is, okay, no.
Yeah.
Get millions in that segment.
If your segment is correct, if you were correct to pick that segment and you're only at 200K in ARR, that means you should be spending all your time plumbing that because you've already got a foothold. The most efficient way to grow, if you have a foothold, is to double down on what's working. Get more of that. Like everything else is higher risk, more expensive, more difficult. Most half of it won't work. Like everything is worse than that. So that's really dumb to go do that. Unless it's going so well, so smooth that you can afford to spend new money, extra money on top of that, which is where, you know, what we got to go to the next area. Now we're talking, but that's not what's going on if you're only there. You probably don't even have product market fit yet, likely, if you're in that zone.
Yeah. Was WP Engine funded or was it bootstrapped?
It started self-funded, but then about 2.5 years in, we took a small round, only 1.2 million. Nowadays, like, you know, you would never take something that little. and then we took a little bit more the next year and just 2 million. So like, again, very, very modest amounts. Now, eventually, fast forward a decade, we've raised 300 million. But one thing I'd say is we always raised an amount that was proportional to things like our revenue. Mm-hmm. And never a crazy revenue multiple. And that always kept it in this sane amount where we were not under nor overvalued.
Yeah.
We never had too much money that made no sense for the operations and scale of the business, or too little money that meant we had to fundraise in 6 months, you know, again, because we ran out already. Those are mistakes. And also, if you, of course, undervalue, then you dilute too fast, which is no good. But if you overvalue, it's really hard because now you have to grow into that valuation so that by the time you raise again, everything had better have gone really, really good, or that next round will be bad. And of course, there's tons of companies right now who are experiencing that problem. And that's what happens when you over a raise. So we never did, we were always very rational about those things. And so we never got into trouble. Plus the company was growing and everything, but still we never, we were very careful to do that well.
Well, that's the reason why I asked it, because that's exactly why so many companies have got into trouble. So first of all, I think it's a mindset to not overdo it, to actually say to venture capitalists, okay, no, a little lower, please. But how have you gone about, for example, this whole mindset of grow at all costs versus, no, we want to be a sustainable company, we are going for profit as well?
The main way we maintain that is, one, our fourth value is built to last. And then under there, we have bullet points that say things like being sustainable and profit is part of what allows us to continue and be the masters of our own destiny and all that kind of stuff. And nowadays, there's a lot of companies that really do live their values. But especially long ago when we were starting, that was not the case. So generally, people assume values is just crap you put on posters on the wall and don't look at and don't do. But we were always very good at actually living them. The way you really live them is, besides like the sort of basic stuff like what you do when no one's looking, is what you do when it's hard and when the trade-off is, okay, here's a moment where we could lose a ton of reputation. It hurts our brand. We lose a ton of money. Something like that that's really obviously and genuinely harmful to the business. And yet we do it anyway because of our values. Our values tell us that we have to make that choice anyway. And you do it. Now you absolutely know that you're living your values for real.
Yes,
right? When it's tested, when it counts. So we did that. So what we did with profitability is, if you're raising money and trying to grow fast, if, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's what people have to do, but if that's your goal, if you really can turn dollars into a lot of value and growth, and on a unit basis, it's really healthy. For example, customers have really high retention and then grow over time. In other words, your NRR is high. You really can, and then you're growing fast and the market is big. You really can justify being way, way non-profitable in order to capture market if that's the case, because you know there's a great healthy company on the other side of that. So HubSpot is a good example of that. Salesforce was a good example of that, and so on. Like you can totally do that if all these other indicators are there saying there's a that success on the other end of this. Of course, a lot of these companies, it's not true that the unit economics were good. And so it was not true. They were just burning money. And that was obvious from the start. And people would argue whether they could ever fix the unit economics. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the issue, is like, no, definitely at current course and speed, they will never be a good company. And the question is, can they ever fix it? Maybe. Sometimes they do. Like Instacart sort of has. And then Uber has never fixed it. So, you know, that it's just a risk you take. That's all. Now, in our case, our unit economics was good. But even so, we were never like drastically in the red. What we did, and I think this is wise for a lot of companies, again, who want to be unprofitable to grow, besides that the unit economics have to make sense, is you want to be unprofitable by a manageable amount, meaning if you wanted to become profitable, you could do it in under a year without completely destroying the business in the process. Like, obviously, most businesses could be profitable by literally firing everybody, but then you destroy the business. So I don't mean that.
Of course.
I mean, you could say, all right, we would pull back here. We wouldn't hire for that. We wouldn't launch the second product. We would, you know, and of course, we don't want to do those things. it's not like it wouldn't affect the business at all. Of course it would, but like you'd still have a basically functioning business if we pulled back and were profitable. If you can still, if you're riding at a profit negative where you could do that, that means you're in control. That means you're using being slightly unprofitable. You really are using it for growth because your unit economics say it'll be worth it in the long run. And you're, it's not wildly out of control from a management or operational perspective. Yeah, that's what we did. Now, today we are profitable and growing. Like we did make that transition to profitability completely along the way. But the way we ran it for years when we weren't is, yeah, but we're not very unprofitable. And, you know, again, that way. Rackspace had an interesting way. This was a hosting company, kind of a generation before ours, not in WordPress specifically, but this was like pre-cloud. They did very well. They had a great culture. They went public. Like it was a great success story. They had an interesting way of measuring that, which they called EBITDA-ism, meaning EBITDA and also without sales and marketing. And the idea was sales and marketing expenses clearly for growth. Duh. If our growth is good, comma, then spending money in sales and marketing is probably fine. If we're spending a lot there and not getting growth, then I mean, something has to give. But if it's working, you know, then just take that out and then ask, now is it profitable? Because if the answer is yes, without sales and marketing, it's profitable. And also our sales and marketing is reasonably efficient, not even super efficient, but just fine. Then it's fine because you're saying I have a fundamentally profitable operation and I'm spending extra so I can grow more. Well, there you go. So that's an example. Now, is that metric wouldn't necessarily be right for every type of company, but it's an idea that could be right because it just takes the growth spend out of the equation and asks, how are we doing?
Exactly. Yeah, that's well said. And that's a very good way to look at it. Because I indeed see so many situations still, even in today's market, where it just cannot add up.
Yes. Well, and then either they're just crazy or they're just, you know, hoping for the next sucker, which can happen, or they genuinely believe that they can address that. It can be fixed. They just need more time. And as an investor in that, you're taking that risk with them, which is it smart or not? Who knows? But it's an understood risk. And then again, so I would ask number one, what do you think? Do you really think they can do that and why? Do they have like a clear plan? Are they starting to get there and it's just a matter of time? Like, why do you think that? And then the other thing is, what is the other super special thing about this company that makes you believe? Like, is it, but if they do it, they're so far and away the leaders. They're like, if they, yeah, it's a risk, but man, if they can pull it off, I mean, it's game over. Like, is that the feeling? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is it their growth is just so ridiculous that it's like, oh, it's just so silly. So like, yeah, let's take a risk on the cost side because this growth is like impossible. YouTube was kind of like that. YouTube salted Google because they were crushed by the legal problems. But everything else about the company was like unbelievably amazing. So if you invest in YouTube there, you're saying, I bet we can fix the legal problems. And why should we bother? Why should we take that risk? Because if we do fix the legal problems, this thing is absolutely insane, which it is. And they did, and Google did fix the legal problems, but it's not clear that they could have otherwise. And it's not clear that Google would necessarily have fixed it. And then it would have been a bad investment, I guess people would say. But that's a very reasonable bet because there were these other great things. Like, so that to me, I know I'm just kind of going on about this, but to me, this is a good way of thinking about bets in general or like that, whether you're an investor in another company or you're investing in your own company with your time and money, right? Is this thing of like, okay, we have this challenge. So it's a risk. So what? Every company has risks. What are they? Can we be really honest about what the risks are? How bad is it? Do we have conviction we can do something about it? Yeah. And is there a balance on the other side of that? Something that's so great that it's worth, it's kind of worth taking this on because, oh boy, sometimes that other side is missing. You're like, this is a company. It's a business idea I have. So I'm sort of just emotionally attached. Yeah, oh, there's these risks. Well, no kidding. They all have risks. What's the good news? There really isn't any good news. Like the market's not that good. We're being crushed by competitors. Our product doesn't really do anything special. It's just that I wanted to do a company. It's like, well, then even if you take the risk and succeed, it's not really that great. Like that doesn't, you see, like that it starts to pull back whether this sounds like, feels like a good bet after all.
What have been a bet where you've had very heavy discussions with the board of the company, whether to go left or right? And how did you take this?
Acquiring a company is always like that.
True.
Not just because of the cost, although that too. You only have so many bullets of certain sizes that you can shoot out of your gun. But also, it's do the products make sense? Is that going to be synergistic? Are they going to continue to grow? What about the team? Is that going to work? So many acquisitions are value destroying, as we all know. There's a lot of data about that, but also if you've just been around the block a few times, you've seen it. it's true. So that's always controversial, and rightly so.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think another one is launching a second or third product line.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing to say, look, lots of customers are asking for X improvement, so we did it. Like, that's not going to be controversial. If you follow your nose reasonably, it's probably fine. But to say, okay, we're going to enter an adjacent area, whether that's an adjacent market or customer's product area, whatever it is that's adjacent, as a growth strategy. And of course, the risk is higher. No one can doubt that. But okay, which of these higher risk, but also potentially higher reward areas are we going to go into? Because if you just incrementally grow while you're scaling or before that, that is correct to do. That's what you should do. So in the very early phase, you should just try to incrementally get your foothold and get product market fit. When you're scaling, it takes all of your time just to scale. So that's what you should do, incremental stuff and work on scale. Once you're kind of on the other side of that, though, then just doing incremental stuff, whether that's in marketing or product, is unlikely to dramatically change the growth curve. And so depending on the kind of company you build or want to build, you may not need to dramatically change your growth curve, but you could just, you know, live on Easy Street now. That's fine. And who knows how long that will last, but so what? Like that's totally fine. If, on the other hand, you want to continue accelerating growth and where can we go from here? How can we use the assets we've now built up to do more? If that's the question, then it's unlikely that incrementally working on your current product is the answer. You're going to have to take some bets, and they are bets, and half of them won't work. You have to take some bets somewhere else to try to layer on new kinds of growth curves. Mm-hmm. Like at HubSpot, they layered on CRM. Actually, first they layered on selling through agencies instead of just direct. Then they layered on CRM. Those are the two big things to change their trajectory, for example.
Exactly.
Or in our case, about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, we launched a new product line called Atlas, which was for headless WordPress sites. And we don't need to get into any of the tech stuff there, but the point is it's WordPress, but it's all different kind of technology, and it's all kind of a new space. And so it's, again, adjacent. It's not, usually you don't add a product that's totally irrelevant, because why are you doing that? It's something's shared, like in how you sell or your customer base or half the tech stack, something shared that makes it adjacent instead of just some random thing. Anyway, so it's still websites, it's still WordPress, but it's this totally different tech stack and often different kinds of people building those sites. And so that's an example of a new product line that we launched at WP Engine.
Well, I mean, you talked about a great number of decisions that you can take over time. I mean, I've indeed been in M&A space, and I've been a part of new product lines, adjacent areas as well. If you just pick one that was particularly difficult, was there a framework whereby you would help you make the right decisions
for things like M&A,
for example? I mean, was there a company? Was it a technology buy, or was it maybe an acquisition to gain market share in a particular area?
Yeah. Certainly, there's different reasons why you buy a company, and so of course you're going to think differently about the decision. So we've done acqui-hires, of course. Then it's about the people, and really, it's about, you know, not just interviewing, but saying, like, we want to bring this talent on board because ... right? But there can't, like, we did buy Flywheel, which was also a managed WordPress company like we are. And so that was more about market share. So there is like a pure financial way to look at it. And then you're looking at things like growth rate and how those metrics intermix with yours will change your overall situation, especially if you're raising money, which for acquisitions, even for self-funded companies, often people go into debt or raise money for an acquisition. And there, like, an interesting question is whether you can buy the company for a lower revenue multiple than your company will be worth even after buying it.
Interesting. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Because in that, you know, so you can let that sink in. But the basic idea is like, well, that means, you know, $1 million of revenue for us is worth this much in stock value. But if we can buy $1 million of revenue for less money than that, then we've just made money on the balance sheet on day one. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot more about acquisitions than that, right? Maybe people get starry-eyed about that, and that's why they screw up the rest of the acquisition, right? Because that's not the only thing. But it's a financial way to get started to ask, does this even make sense financially in the first place, which may be a good gate. Another thing you have to consider is your strategy. sometimes a company's for sale and it's like, ooh, should we just get it? It's like, there's a cookie in the cookie jar. Should we eat it? Mm-hmm. Without asking like, well, what's our diet? What's our long-term goal here? Is that what we need to do? Or you get fear. Well, but if someone else buys it, won't that be bad for us? So maybe we need to buy it preemptively or something like that. These are usually bad reasons. I go back to like your strategy, meaning by that, I mean your way of winning. Here's what our strengths are. Here's what our positioning is. Here's the right market for us. Here's how we win in there, meaning why people love us for whatever reasons they love us and how that compares with the competition and where we're good. And that kind of stuff is what I mean by strategy.
Yeah, true.
So does this acquisition fit into that? Does it either accelerate our progression in our strategy or de-risk the strategy? Yeah. Like, oh, we wanted to add on this adjacent product line. Well, one way is to build it, but it takes a long time and it's high risk whether we're successful. Yeah. If you acquire the product you wanted to buy anyway that was adjacent, so you pay more in cash, but you've de-risked whether it will work, whether it will grow, and you've sped up the timeline, which has value. And so that's what you're paying for. Again, there's more to it than that, but that's a really good reason. So if I already had a strategy that said, we want to enter this adjacent market because here's our reasons already, then the question is, well, how shall we enter? Build, buy, partner is the usual three choices. Now you have a strategic reason to buy a company. That's a much better reason, place to begin. So I think those are a couple of things. It has to align with the strategy and either accelerate it or de-risk it, not take you in some random direction that you didn't want to go in. I say all that, an acqui-hire is kind of an exception to all that. An acqui-hire really is hiring. That's why it's called that. In that case, you're hiring talent. You don't need everything I just said. You can throw away and just say, did you really want to hire these people anyway? Yeah, I really wanted to. I just couldn't because they had a company. Okay, well, that's what you did is you gave them a huge signing bonus to put down their toys and join you. And that's just hiring. I say just like it's easy. It's not. Hiring is hard too, but it's straightforward. I wanted to hire them anyway. If we give them more money, we can. Okay, like that's the end of it. You know, the end of the story.
Well, I mean, you've clearly been involved in a number of acquisitions, and I've been in the same ball game when I was at Unit 4. We also at some point almost became a holding company. What has been the strategy from WP Engine? Was it to acquire and never merge, or was it always to merge as well? And what have you learned from that?
We've only really acquired. We haven't done a merger.
Yeah, see? What's the reason for that?
We've always been by far the leader. There's one other company, Automatic, who is, you know, the same order of magnitude size as we are. So that could make sense. But again, we grew so fast for so many years that there is no, other than Automatic, there wouldn't be anyone to merge with in that sense of being a similar scale.
Yeah. But yeah, well, maybe the word is wrong there because you can buy smaller companies. The question at the end is like, how much do you make them part of your organization? And that's all.
Oh,
that's
completely.
At the end.
Yeah, yeah. We never done a thing where we like acquire and then throw away the people. That like we never, ever done that.
Well, one of the things that we did at Unit 4, for example, just to give us some context, is that we say, okay, well, we buy you. And I mean, you keep your logo, you keep your name, you keep everything. Just keep doing what you do well. Mm-hmm. See?
So I guess the question is, what is your strategy for which that's the right thing to do?
Yeah.
It could be, a defensive move of, look, so this is what happened with Instagram and Facebook. They said, keep everything, right? Obviously, we know there was other influences and ads, but in terms of like the brand and product, it was keep everything and go. So there, it was defensive. It was, oh, Instagram is winning over a different segment that Facebook is not winning. So we need them under our umbrella so that as that grows and prospers, like that's on our same team. So that's fine. That's a good reason to do it. And that would be a reason to keep it separate, because if it is a growth juggernaut and accessing an area of the market you can't access, then you would have to keep the brand and the product and keep it going, because that's what you bought. You bought the growth of that thing. If you were to get rid of that thing, you have undone the growth that you said you were buying. Of course, companies do that. And again, as we said, as we both agree, like, yeah, companies break this all the time, you know, but that makes sense. On the other hand, like if that's not the reason you bought it, it may not make sense to do that. So
have you done any technology buys whereby it's the kind of the acquisition strengthened the WP engine?
Not really. Although sometimes the talent of the people, I guess a little bit. A little. That wasn't the main reason, though. Like sometimes the technology is good, but that wasn't the reason we bought it. Like if that's all they had, we wouldn't have bought it. But there's things where it's like, oh yeah, it is the people, or perhaps it is the technology. In which case, they don't have a brand that's interesting. They're not tapping into a new segment that's interesting. And so, why would we dilute who we are? Why we confuse the market with some new brand? No. It would just be better for us and our brand, our leadership and innovation and all those kind of words to say, look, we're doing all this too. And everyone goes, wow, that WP Engine, they sure keep innovating. Okay. So then that makes sense, right?
Good point. Looking at the time, a couple more questions and then we'll wrap it up. What has been the hardest nut to crack on this journey whereby things didn't go as expected? Growth flattened, for example. Has there been any moment like that? And what did you do?
Well, if you look at our overall growth curve, it's surprisingly stable.
Yeah, I saw your blog on the exponential growth.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many competitors over the last 14 years and alternatives to WordPress, like Shopify and Wix and Squarespace and Webflow, yeah. And, you know, ToastTab even for restaurants. And yet our growth curve is very stable. So in that high level sense, we haven't had some kind of crisis like that. But on a more micro scale or tactical scale, of course, things go badly all over the place, you know, for various times and reasons and stuff. And, you know, some are self-inflicted and some aren't, and there's all kinds of things. So you're saying things that are going well and then stop going well, right?
Yeah, that you didn't see coming. And like, what can you learn from that?
For a lot of people, 2020 was that.
Yeah,
obviously through no fault of their own. So it's still a really interesting question. What do you do about that? In our case, by that time, we're 10 years old at that point. By that time, we had a diverse customer base. Mm-hmm. And what we found, perhaps not by design or construction, but it's still interesting, perhaps for people on the call who could design for this. What we found is that, let me put it this way. It's easy to think about the companies and see that all companies suffered. Mm-hmm. I say all in quotes, I guess some didn't, but like most companies suffered. But when you look at what companies spent money on, there were winners and losers in there.
Yeah.
So for example, for our smaller customers, they're going out of business, having trouble, all this stuff. We did all kinds of things to just pause people's payments for a long, long time or credits or whatever, one way or another, they don't have to pay us to help them out. So we tried to help out people as much as we could. Nevertheless, people are going to go out of business, obviously. So on that end, there was a lot of carnage that obviously isn't our fault. And there's, you know, we tried to do things about it, but it is what it is. But if you're a large company, McDonald's isn't going out of business because of COVID. Mm-hmm. That's not what's happening. But they do look at their budgets and go, geez, we need to spend less on stuff.
Yeah.
Now, for a small customer, we're expensive, but for McDonald's, we're cheap.
Yeah, true.
And so on the big end, they see us as the low cost alternative. Yeah. And all of a sudden, we're a great option over COVID.
Yeah.
Not because the company's not suffering due to COVID, they are, but because of that suffering, the budgets get smaller. And all of a sudden, the more affordable but still enterprise grade software, true. Like if we were just bad, then they couldn't use us. But if we're enterprise level and cheaper, then maybe even by 10 or 100 times through other kinds of enterprise tools like Adobe Experience Manager or Acquia or Sitecore. These things are 10 or 100 times more expensive than us. You can say, okay, we can still launch some campaigns. We can still do some stuff. We're just going to do it over here where we can afford to do it. It makes more sense now. So one area of the market contracts, the other one might grow, even though all companies in the market, roughly speaking, are hurting. So yeah. Another way to look at that, because COVID, you know, you can't plan for it, obviously. But what does happen periodically is things like recessions. And you could say the same kind of a thing, just for a general recession. It's just there are winners and losers and so forth. And so as you think about your customer base, if you're really early on in the company, you can't afford to think about this. Again, you just need to get a foothold, get product market fit, get the thing working, have a couple of people there full time so that this is a real going concern. Like that's all you can do. Once, though, it's a going concern, if you're in millions of ARR, certainly tens of millions of ARR, you can start going, now look, we want to be healthy for the long run. There will be different economic things. There could be this, there could be that. There could be winners and losers in that. How could we be better positioned not to prevent any, you know, well, you could say, like, how could we be better positioned for even the the more vulnerable customers to stay. You could, you know, potentially, but you could also ask, like, how could that change? And what would we want to do even now or in the next couple of years to be better prepared? So again, I mentioned one. We had to be enterprise grade. So in other words, if we didn't have our ISO certification, if we didn't have our SOC 2 certification, if we didn't have a security team that when the, well, I don't want to name all our customers. I don't remember who we're allowed to say or not. But when the CISO, the chief security officer for a Fortune 500 company mm-hmm. talks to our security team, is that person impressed? Or are they like, oh my God, you don't know what you're doing?
Yeah.
These are things you can do ahead of time. Having the things where the larger companies can say yes because you tick all the boxes.
Yep.
You can invest in that somewhat, not a ton, not pivoting the company. You don't have to do that, right? But you could say, all right, we could maybe add on a segment there. There are certain things we would need to have in place or want to have in place. And we could grow in general in those segments, in general. Yep. And then in particular, if things get shaken up, this now gives me more of what in finance you might call a balanced portfolio, where one goes down, the other goes up, and you know, right? Like you can think that way.
That's the way it
again,
works.
You need to be at a certain scale and a certain kind of healthy position to think that way. But when it is time to expand the market or think about that, you could add this into where should we expand, how to be adjacent. You could add in this notion of if the economy fluctuates or in different countries fluctuate or, you know, et cetera, like what, or different verticals, like AI comes around and disrupts some companies, some verticals faster than others. Okay.
Yeah.
So am I in different verticals or am I concentrated in one vertical where my fortunes go up and down with the one vertical? Good example for us. Very early on, WordPress was for bloggers. You might expand that to say WordPress is for media. Okay. But if that's all WordPress ever was, or if that's what we specialized in, that would probably be a great way to get started. Like that's a good wedge in. It's like, we're just going to be the best for a media company. Great. If you never went away from that, then when Google has a crazy SEO thing and now media companies are harmed, you're harmed, or AI comes along and it's unclear what that means for media. Now it's unclear what it means for you. Whereas if well, we started with websites for media, but now we're in e-commerce and in people's homepages and in LMS systems and internal systems, you know, now it's still not good for you if media is hurt, but you're not killed. So this notion of
have multiple eggs in multiple baskets.
Yeah, it can be good. And so we've seen various things, some of which might be our fault and some of which like COVID is of course nobody's fault, where you can see that stability and being useful.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. That's the same thing I also experienced at Unit 4. You know, we were in public and private markets in the services industry. And when the government had its election year, don't even think about making your targets there, but some other markets would make up for it. Now, that is a great way to be diversified. Last question. From all the years of entrepreneurship, particularly looking at the last 40 years being the founder of WP Engine, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with peer tech entrepreneurs?
What size company?
Yeah, that's a good one. Companies between 5 million and 100 million.
So in that phase, you're scaling. Like you have product market fit, that's not a question, but you're dealing with scale. And unless you've been in that zone for 10 years and just not growing very fast or not at all, then you're not done yet working on that. And it's probably consuming every day. In that case, I think one challenge, first of all, is that there's very little written about that zone. I think there's a million books about how to go from zero to one, maybe product market fit type of stuff. Me too. I write about that a lot too, so I'm guilty. And there's a ton of things about the sort of big successes. Here's what Apple did in the 90s to turn it around. It's fascinating, but it has nothing to do with you when you have 25 million in revenue. And so there's not zero books, but there's just very, very little compared to the rest. What happens here? So I think that's maybe a ripe area for more help. So one thing that you should not do is believe that just because you got to this point, you know how to get to the next point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phrase, what got us here will not get us there.
Yeah.
It's common because it's true, but also it's so common that it's sort of this throwaway thing. People are like, yeah, we got to do something different. Anyway, let's get back to life. And they don't really fully ingest what that means. It means you might not be the right CEO. It means the employee number one, who you are so loyal to, you would give them a kidney, needs to leave.
Yeah.
It can mean that a whole product is not going to get you there. It could mean that there's all kinds of areas you know nothing about in finance and HR and so forth, and you're now late in getting them, and you don't even know that, and you don't know how to hire it. And like, so you have like these levels of unknown, and you're just sitting there going, I'm a genius. I got us a $50 million revenue. We're just going to keep solving problems because that's what we do. Incorrect. Just figuring it out as you go does not work anymore at scale. And lots of companies crater and have terrible working environments or even kind of falter in there. And there's many reasons, but that's one of the reasons. So one don't is to not say, look, we got this far, so this is the right team and the right process, the right everything, and we'll just kind of iterate from here because that's what we've been doing. Incorrect. Iteration is no longer right. And especially if you're going fast, there's no time to learn on the job. You have to hire people that have seen the movie a few times. They'll still make mistakes, but they need to be making better idiosyncratic mistakes and not just procedural, systematic mistakes that are just because you're ignorant about this very different phase of business. So that's one big don't, is going like, we'll just keep doing it. For a do, so what I do think is wrong would be to say, well, we'll just change out all management or make like really like dramatic changes like that. Like, we need a leader of every department who has seen scale. That's too drastic. So one thing I do think you could do is you could say, are there one or two areas in the business, but probably a department, but it doesn't have to be so specific, where it's either scaling the fastest, and so we need people who've seen the movie the most there, or it's our biggest blind spot. Like, I'm not even sure what all goes in that department. Okay. Yep. Right. And so either way, it's this huge problem.
Yeah.
And could you get some seasoned leadership there? So not trying to get it everywhere all at once and change everything, but like, could you, the thing that's like under the most dire need of scale or biggest blind spot, so you can plug that blind spot with someone who can see, that person also probably can help with some of the meta problems with scale, meaning you hire a fantastic CFO, and not only can they take care of the CFO stuff and facilities and HR and all this kind of stuff, not only can they do that, but they probably have some general systems for managing people, multiple structures, how to do hiring processes when that's scaling up also, how to do performance management when there's multiple levels, how you hire and manage things like VPs differently from a manager, planning on quarterly or annual basis. I don't love actually sticking to the calendar, but let's just say every 100 days or so, you should poke your head up, and maybe once or twice a year, you should, you know, take some time to look around a little before you go back in the hole. So whatever that means, they probably have some frameworks and tools and ideas and things that are reasonable. And so they can take care of the area, but they can probably also help the entire company work better. So having one or two people like that, I would add, and that will help you scale a lot without like dramatically changing the whole company. And again, as long as it's focused on either an area that's rapidly scaling and therefore getting out of control very fast, or just a huge blind spot. So like, you don't even know what you don't know, like, let's maybe fix that. And so like, if you're scaling really fast and you're a product or engineering leader, you might be able to hang on. But then you look over at the HR area and you're like, I don't even know. It's like, well, that's not okay. It's not okay to just not even, like, the company needs that to be known. Since you're not the one to do it, you don't even want to do it, you're not spending your time doing it, you don't know how to hire. Like, well, who's going to fix that? Like, you know, okay, so if it's a big hole like that, then that's a good reason to bring in a new person, and they can probably help in general.
Perfect. Wise advice. I mean, we can talk for hours more. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom. It's been fascinating to have you on the call. I keep following you. I keep reading your blog it's every week, right? But at least once a week.
Yeah.
I'll put the way to sign up in the show notes. Where can people go to find out more about WP Engine or to say hi to you?
Yeah. So WP Engine is, of course, wpengine.com. That's easy. And I'm, as you said, that because of the Smart Bear company, I'm still a Smart Bear on Twitter. Asmartbear.com is where the blog is. And yeah.
Perfect. Good. Well, thank you very much, Jason. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Keep inspiring and keep growing WP Engine.
Thank you.
And this ends my conversation with Jason. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Jason Cohen, founder of WP Engine. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.